listener production.
From the Inside with Peter Ricks.
This is part two of Peter's conversation with legend of AM radio in the 1970s and then FM radio in the 1980s, Rod Muir. In this episode, Rod talks about those big early days when FM turned on, Triple M hit the airwaves, and the personal friendships forged.
So then we're in the radio station opens, Triple M opens. The Catholics are now history and...
No, they weren't straight away.
No, but in your mind there,
well,
you've moved on. Yeah. But the that moment when that lovely, sweet, clear music, you know, distorted as Neil Young might be...
No, that was just a test.
Yeah, I understand. That it arrives in anybody who loved music suddenly had another place to go to listen to things, right? Yeah. It was a destination that was immediate. And yet my memories of this were that virtually straight away there was this family in Bondi that you felt that you, on air in particular, and that, you know, that obviously started with Uncle Doug and then there was...
Well, he didn't join straight away.
Really?
No, he wasn't there for a couple of years. We got him off Triple J. That was a payback.
So who was that? Was Wally, Keith Williams, was he there?
Keith Williams was on air. I can't remember a lot of them, but
the journey of that group that you then brought together.
We did the same. We had a music source station.
Yeah,
there was a formula involved that would get us there. We were never beaten. You know, we started off, we only had Willis E. Laws and Kennedy as opponents. And, you know, I'd gone to John and Michael and said...
And that was Today, that's Today FM.
They got the Today license.
Yeah.
The second one. And I went to them and said, look, you know, I'm not trying to threaten you or tell you what to do, but this is what I'm going to do. And I'm good at it, and you guys are television people, and I'll skin you alive if you transgress against this line.
Right.
I will be unmercifully ruthless, and I will work 24 hours a day, and I want us to be friends, and so don't just waste your money and your time. You take that and leave us alone.
Which they did. Yeah, they did.
Well, it made common sense.
Yeah.
Dear Michael... you know, land a lot of money out of it,
yeah.
Which he then brought the Swans to Sydney.
Yeah, that's true.
He did.
Yeah, no, that is true. In those days, there was, because Graham Kennedy was in there somewhere as well.
He was, the three of them.
Yeah, and there was peace and harmony in the back paddock at the time.
They were really good at it, and the guys worked really hard at it. You know? I remember one of the license applicants, because it was all, everyone had a QC silk, and everyone was performing at before the broadcast tribunal. And one of the QCs looked at Willis E. Laws and Kennedy and said, I'm so tempted to support your application to think I could switch you all off with one switch.
Oh, dear. So inside at Triple M over those, let's call the first 5 years, some seriously talented on-air people were there, you know, Denton was
well,
a part of it.
Denton came and worked as a, because Murray had joined.
Yeah.
And he wanted to have writers.
Yeah.
I said, well, I'll pay you a bit of money. I'm not employing writers.
So he had to pay him.
I'll give you, well, I set a budget so that he had to live within that budget because it came out of his pocket.
And is breakfast, and I don't just talk about Doug, but breakfast, beyond breakfast, is it destroying in the end? Or can you... Like the in-laws and those guys ended up pretty much leaving and getting to the middle of the day so they could get some more sleep. But it always, I mean, I guess I'm learning this out of your time at 2SM, but there was always the breakfast show had to work in order for the rest of the day to then roll.
It helps. It helps. There's no doubt when Mulray joined us, he improved our breakfast numbers because we were just a music source at that stage and happy to be there because we wanted to be envisaged as, you know, a good time.
Yeah.
And then Mulray came. And the biggest problem with Doug was I said, look, happy to do a deal. These are the parameters. This is the structure. You can do what you like here, 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 and here, but the rest of it flows. And it was always a battle with Doug to get him to toe the line on that.
But that personality thing, that's surely the heart, the fine line between the music and allowing the personality freedom to do it.
It is, yeah, it is, it is. It's a, you know, an art form because the personality of that calibre, the bigger the personality, you know, the more they think every word they say is a gushing moment of brilliance and it's not.
Mm.
And to get them to be concise and to understand that they are in living in a house of music where music is the primary function.
So did it ever get too hard managing those egos?
No, not really. Not really because, you know, like, I mean,
because you had layers under you that were meant to do the micro, but inevitably, you're the one at midnight ringing them to say,
well,
and going back to sleep straight away, of course.
No, that was a 2SM thing, really. I can't remember the Triple M thing at that stage, but I probably did less of that, but nonetheless, you can't manage something. You can't. How can you manage someone doing a job function that you don't know how he does it?
Yeah, quite.
So you have to be able to do everything yourself in order to be a good leader.
But I always thought you were the great motivator in that place. The momentum of the radio station came always from you.
And because it was a passion. Nothing great in life ever happens without passion.
Yeah, so in the midst of that motivation, there are sometimes when you're brutal, honest but brutal, in order to get where you've got to go.
Determined, I'd put, rather than brutal.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Frank.
Absolutely. What's wrong with being frank?
No, quite.
You know, I mean, the worst thing is someone who waffles and says something and the other person goes, God, they're enthusiastic about it. What was he saying?
So then part of that is truthfully to be unconventional because you don't continually do the same thing all the time denies the need for reinvention. So in being unconventional within the radio process, were there times when some of those decisions that you decided to make didn't work, or
lots,
really?
Lots, yeah. But you just admit your mistakes quickly. You know, otherwise you'd be fearful of making any decision. You know, like just own up. You know, the problem with people who make decisions is that they try desperately to camouflage the fact that they were wrong. And it's much quicker to say, much, much more efficient. And as for, you know, fulfilling a functional in robotic form, your problems don't occur in any business like that.
No.
You know, your problems are occurring by outside influences and other factors, and you've got to be where the trouble is, you know? I mean, there's too many people. If we went to lunch to get smashed, we went to lunch to get smashed and pulled the blinds down.
Mm.
And they'd know we didn't pretend we were doing something else. We were out there getting smashed.
I used to have a rule when I worked with Warner Brothers and my beloved friend Paul Turner, who ran Warner Brothers, who you'll remember.
Yeah.
And the dog, as we called him, I always used to go for the visits in the morning, and I'd ring his secretary and say, "Now, is he going to lunch today?" If he was going to lunch, you never tried to do a deal in the afternoon. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, that's true. It's true, but that wasn't. I mean, I was with guys from the station.
Yeah, yeah, you know, no.
We would be celebrating something. There would be a reason that we were going out and getting smashed, but we didn't do it that often. But when we did it, everyone seemed to notice because we did it well.
Mate, relationships remain the key to most of the world.
We got into French champagne and we were buying pink Moet and Chandon, I remember. We had a attention for, by the palate.
Oh.
And he says, I said, well, we'd get so much cheaper, you know, it was such a better deal.
Of course. Why buy it by the single bottle? I agree.
Well, no, it was good. But also in that time, you are making other friends, you know. I was racing yachts at the time too. So you know, you were lessening the amount of time that you were spending at work, the more successful it became. And Dennis Connors, you know, I'd raced against a couple of times, and he came out, and we were pretty friendly. I had a house on Elizabeth Bay and just around the corner from the cruising yacht club, and with his own jetty, and as the boat came out to the start line with 24 guys on board, they'd send a tender in to pick me up and be on the boat for the start of the race.
Yeah, wonderful.
Well, it was civilised living. But one of the things I was going to say then was, it was Gough Whitlam. I had him down to lunch one day. He was always my hero. You talk about someone that is maligned in later life. And I remember there was... We sat down to lunch and I was just like a fan, you know. It had been in the news that week that the CIA perhaps had something to do with his dismissal. I don't know whether you remember the story. Anyway, he came and I said, Gough, the CIA, is that true? And he said, no. I said, well, what was it with the dismissal? He said, no, it was just Kerr afraid to lose his job. And he went on to explain to me, because, like, great people are great communicators,
yes,
in simple terms. Yeah. And he summed it up this way, and it was the best description of his being fired. He said he was afraid to lose his job because he was the first Australian Governor General. Before that, they'd all been POMs, and their remuneration after they left the job was always settled out of England. And Gough had said, we will have an Australian and I will look after him. And when it came down to the crunch, Fraser, who was a very smart operator, went to Kerr and said, you either do this or you won't have a superannuation and you won't have a job.
I have a memory of Gough. A personal memory of Gough, where when I ran the ARIE Awards for all those years, I was privy to who would win. And in one particular year, the Whitlams won Album of the Year. And I knew this like a week out from the Capitol Theatre of the television show. And so I rang his private secretary, and they wouldn't have known me from Adam, but he had an office up in Westfield in William Street. And asked if he would come and present the award that night without the band knowing they'd won. And the bastard turned up. He was one of the great human beings of our time.
Oh, listen, he is.
And when he got up and opened the envelope, because he didn't know either who was going to win.
Oh, you didn't tell him.
But he certainly knew that there was a band called the Whitlams.
What a great moment.
And so he opened the envelope and on national television... And opens it up, takes a look at it, and looks at the camera and smiles and says, my children, you may join me on the stage. Tim Friedman came up. They were genuflecting on the floor. It's one of those great moments.
He was such a marvellous human being. But you talk about people who have imagery perceptions other than what they really are. Jimmy Barnes. Jimmy is one of the most generous, nicest people that I've ever met, and I've been to the concerts when he's had a swig or two of a vodka bottle, you know, and he's no doubt has great capacity for consumption when he's rocking. But he is an absolute gentleman, and he and Jane are just royalty. You know, together as a pair. Yeah. I mean, and yet his imagery perception is that of a wild man. You know, I mean, he has his moments.
Australia, and maybe I'm a little older for it now, but that we've all grown up as Jimmy's grown up, and And, you know, I was there at the Bondi Lifesaver in the corner with Wayne DiGrucci and the things that went on in there that we're just not going to talk about on a broadcast. No. But they were Jimmy wrote a book. The second one's due out if it's not out now. Mm. And in it, the level of his honesty about his life and times reflects enormously on the sort of human being he is.
And that's the way he is.
Yeah.
That's the way he is. We went to stay with them in Thailand when the kids were all very young.
Yeah.
And I was absolutely staggered by, I mean, he's the sort of father everyone would love to have. You know, his attention to the kids and his love of the children and his work ethic.
Yeah.
You know,
well, that's it, isn't it?
He committed to several hours a day to write, and he just loved all music.
Yeah.
It wasn't just rock and roll. He loved country music. He loved it all.
Yeah.
You know, he's a complete package.
This is From the Inside with Peter Ricks, and this is part two of his conversation with one of the godfathers of Australian radio, Rod Muir. In a moment, they talk about Triple M extending into Melbourne and Rod moving on from radio. Rod also finally clears up the story about the end of his era at Triple M, the chainsaw and the boardroom table.
All right, so it's up and running. That beautiful boat, Windward Passage, arrives, the most gorgeous boat I've ever seen in my entire life, that first one that you bought out.
Nice, yeah.
Was there a time then when you started to think about the next stages of your journey? Were you happy to stay inside?
It was all part of a plan, really, you know, from once you got the license. Firstly, you know, we had a maximum shareholding of 10%. There was only one common denominator. I was a 10% shareholder between all the parties. That was me. They ranged from Harry Vander and George Young in one instance to, you know, my father-in-law, who was the chairman, you know, and Sir Ian Turbutt.
It meant you had gone out and got... It wasn't as if you went to high society to get the money.
I knew them all. I was the only one common denominator. And so when the time came when I knew that it was about to blow, I went to everyone and said, look, I'll pay you seven times your original investment in 3 years or whatever it was. And those that were in working with us, I said, stay in for the ride. Mm. But then I moved my 10% to 70.3 or something so that I had control of the memorandum and articles.
Mm.
And then I went to Melbourne and set a price precedent by buying Eon.
Mm.
And
well, that gave you the network, really, didn't it? Sydney, Melbourne.
Well, yes, but it was more to set a price precedent of the value of a license. Nick Whitlam was my banker. He was always my banker. I mean, he was running the state bank, and I'd said to Nick on the phone, I was going down, I said, so how much can I spend? He said, well, he wins a maths, Rod. And he was really impressed with my ability to he thought I was rigging the books, in fact, the first 2 years. He said, you can't go into a crank-up operation and be that, because we were going from $2 million turnover to $4 million to $8 million.
Mm.
And I was right within $10,000 of all outgoings and incomings and stuff. When he questioned me on it, I said, well, listen, you know, I don't know what you're doing here. Don't, you know, and the fact that I'm your best operator, you know, you should check your values of the people you have as clients. Anyway, so we got on really well, and I said, how much can I spend? And I think it was like $30 million or something. And I went down to the board down there, and I wanted to close the deal, and they were humming and hawing, and TUW had people on the board, and they were going, oh, yes, well, maybe, and that. And I said, well, eventually I said, look, what about $34 million? Let's go, and we'll do the deal now. And it was a much bigger number than they thought they could do, so we did the deal. And I came back and rang Nick and said, how'd you go? And I said, well, it's good news and bad news. He said, well, give me the good news first. And I said, well, we got the deal. We got the license. He said, that's great, Rob. What's the bad news? I said, I had to spend $4 million more than you gave me. He said, oh, neither here nor there, that's fine.
Yeah. They were the good old days.
Yes, but then doing the maths, and I wasn't so sure that I've never trusted governments, really. I just think they're a moving feast. And I didn't, as I'd had it set up, my capital gains and everything were tax-free. And so I just set it up on a deal where I think I left with $50 million cash tax-free.
But so were you happy to move on at that stage?
Well, what was it going to do? I'd done it for 30 years.
I get it that for you, there's other challenges, other things to
look
for.
Well, yes. No. I went and learned. We built a farm, and it was a very beautiful farm. We got the timber out. They were building Parliament House, and we got the timber all off the dull, because they always overorder.
Oh, wow.
And so each of the bedrooms in this main house was a hewn pine room and a rosewood room and other room. And I'd been at John Cornell's place up in Byron Bay, and that'd been our inspiration. So we got his architect, the same guy who was a very, very good architect, and we got all the people that built all the hippies out of the hills and stuff that were capable of doing this stuff. And they came down for 3 years, and we built this farm, and we went to Russia because they wanted horses. And when they said, what sort of horses? I didn't realise there was more than one sort of horse, and... So I had a look around, and they said, I said, Arabian horses were so beautiful. And I said, well, let's do that. So then we went to Russia because Russia had funded the Aswan Dam for Egypt. And Egypt had, as a thank you, given Russia their best young stallion for that year. And he turned out to be the greatest sire of all time, called Aswan, of course. And he had just died, and his last daughter was for sale. So we rocked up, and Kathy and I, outbid Mrs. Wrigley.
As in Wrigley chewing gum?
Yes, who had a farm on Catalina Island. I don't know, it was $100,000 or something. It didn't seem a lot at the time because we were racing maxi boats, and
yes,
that was pretty expensive. Anyway, we got these Arabian horses and we got them down. So like, life is biting off more than you can chew, and chewing like buggery. And so we had to learn about having foals and how to breed horses. And then I wanted to grow flowers, so I built this nursery, and I learned how to grow daylight responsive plants like chrysanthemums at Mother's Day and poinsettias at Christmas, and orchids.
I can blame Glenn Wheatley then for setting you loose into the horse business, or was that all on
Wheatley was the... Wheatley was the guy that ended up. Well, he would pay the money, and it made sense that he should come in and do it. I don't know Glenn that well, but I don't know how well he did at it. He didn't seem to hold on to it too long.
No, he certainly didn't. So then, as you may fondly remember, I was at lunch with you and
yes,
a small group of others.
That was a great day.
When we seem to order, you seem to order every single bottle of French wine that was available in the restaurant in celebration of this extraordinary moment.
We did.
And then at some point you headed back to the radio station. And
with Frank.
Yes.
Well, Frank Mancini, who was the chief engineer, he had left 2 weeks before because we'd all planned our escape at the same time. And Frank had said... he came back for the lunch on the last day, and I said, Frank, did they look after you? Did they give you a present? He said, yeah, it was great. I said, what did they give you? He said, a chainsaw. I said, a chainsaw? He said, yeah, but it was what I wanted. I said, what do you want a chainsaw for? And he said he was going up to Coffs Harbour or somewhere, and he said, do you know, when they gave it to me, I had this overwhelming desire to cut the table. To cut it in half. We had this giant boardroom table that was, you could seat, I think, 12 people around. It was Tasmanian oak.
And I said, what a great idea. We'd had a couple of drinks at the time. And I said, do you think, this is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I said, do you think you can go home and get it? And he said, yeah. So we got him a cab straight away. And he went to get the chainsaw. And we held off Wheatley and the handover till 6 o'clock at night. And, of course, the moment we decided, said, let's go for it, Frank. And I explained to the staff that it was just a symbolic gesture, that we were a certain type of administration which was about to finish, in our opinion, and I couldn't possibly speak for the incoming people, but I had seen the way they fondly look at their accountants, and I was doubtful as to whether the same vibe would continue. And Wheatley standing there with his mates and he's looking aghast. And anyway, I said, come on, Frank, let's do it. So Frank just gets up on the table and gets a chainsaw going, and the air conditioning, of course, it was 6 o'clock, went off. And so the smoke came out of the, it wasn't going anywhere. And he picked the part in the table where the bolts were holding it together.
Oh.
So it'd go really well for about a foot, and then sparks would fly everywhere as he buggered his chainsaw, cutting through another bolt. So it took some time to get through.
I think Glenn Wheatley's scarred for life by that afternoon. I don't think he's ever forgotten it.
He hasn't forgotten it, but what annoys me a bit about it is that some of the people that were there, one of which is Wheatley, they say I cut the table, which was an insult to Frank, really.
Yeah, quite.
The fact that I was incapable of handling a chainsaw at that stage of my existence never crossed their minds. And then somebody told me that I then raced into the studio with the chainsaw going and held it at the neck of the guy on air, and I've gone, this is just going too far, you know.
Mate, urban mythologies, you got to...
It's amazing, isn't it?
Do you still miss it at all?
A little bit, but it can never be the same.
Yeah.
It can never be the... We were an absolute embracing of the inmates running the asylum. And
they were a hell of a family, Rod, that whole
yes,
thing.
Yes, but every time I walk into a radio station, you know, the administrators or the managers or whatever their title they give themselves just look at me in horror. I mean, my existence and the fact that I'm still alive, they feel threatened by it, that I could live through that and live. But, I don't know about the current administration of radio stations, but they're not like we were.
Yeah. I paused after that because we are in a radio station at the moment.
That's okay. So this is probably one of the better ones.
Yeah, it is. Now, so the people like Frank and Miss Barb, who we met at the front door on the way in, all part of that family who's still... Yes. Is Frank still in the game?
I don't know.
No.
I haven't seen Frank for years.
Yeah.
But not only that, you would come in and feel free to be in the place and wander through into offices and speak to people. Bob Hawke did too.
Yeah.
I mean, Bob Hawke was when he was trying to be the Prime Minister and he was going through elections, he came up in Bondi Junction, and as you do on the lift here, and the lift's open. And we'd heard he was coming, and I was running a bit of research, and I knew he was a shoo-in, you know, and so besides, I liked he's a larrikin,
and I
like larrikins, and so the rednecks of the Liberal Party were coming on with this crap about reds under the bed and people taking their money out of banks and stuffing it under mattresses, so we were so broke. We've just started, you know, and so we went down and borrowed a bed from David Jones, and the bank would only give us $2,000, you know, our own bank. And so we got that in denominational and stuck it out from under the mattress. And I got someone in a bottle shop to lend me a bottle of Grange, and we stuck it under the bed. And anyway, Hawke came out, and he's like, I'd never met him before, and he's just looked around, and I've gone and said, thanks for coming. And he's looked and he's gone straight to the bed and he's gone, he could smell a good story here. And he's gone, oh, cash under the mattress, hey? And he said, don't suppose there's no reds under the bed. And I've gone, well, as a matter of fact, and pulled out the grange. And he's grabbed the grange like that and the cameras were about to get him because he'd given up the squirt. And I said, but you're not interested in that at all at the moment, are you? And he said, no, I'm not. And I said, well, that's great. And he knew I saved him from that bad moment. And anyway, we became quite good friends.
Yeah.
And he too would come up to the radio station with Bob Hogg and when they had to fill in time because they felt safe there and he'd use the boardroom and he'd smoke his silly cigar
yeah.
and whatever he was on about. And I remember one day we were walking through and we were doing quite well and he said, something came up about tax, and I said, well, I paid $1 million to the bloody tax department just last week or something. He said, did you? And I said, yeah, isn't it great? He said, really? Why'd you spend that much? I said, because it's... I said, imagine how well I'm doing if I paid you $1 million. You know, I said, life's fantastic. I'm really happy to pay tax. And he's gone, oh, and so, you know, like, he thought I was a weirdo, but a nice one, you know, and
yeah. But there's something missing in that world of creativity, which is what it all is. In the end, yes. you can't run your life. I mean, in the modern world, people want to, where procurement and purchasing decide everything you're going to do. But I mean, Bob Hawke was another one of those people that he made a decision and he followed it through. And if it was right, it was yeah. a good thing. If it wasn't, then he'd apologise and keep going.
Yes.
I think
and
those...
he'd change it, absolutely.
Not much of that happens anymore.
He was a leader.
Yeah, quite.
And that's what we suffer from.
Is there a... Apart from all these lovely stories, is there a favourite memory for you? Is it more about life on the boats and... that, or is it during those radio days? Because there's so many people that will hear this, but who really have memories and if not worked in that world. For you.
These were great days. These were great days. Nothing particularly one memory. The joyful circumstance of being able to... I remember when NXS started and we heard that band and they were so good.
Yeah.
They were so good. And we managed to put them to air live, you know, and that was so... And it worked because we had Mancini and people like that that could understand, you know, and Chris Murphy was going through a very likeable stage and...
So, somebody... I read referred to you as the godfather that likes to start grass fires and then afterwards helps fan the flames. Did you ever hear that quote?
No, but yeah, it's that's fair enough. You know, it's exciting to do things. That's what makes industries good. That's what always attracted me about radio is that it has so much immediacy and flexibility. There's very little that you can't do straight away.
Yeah,
you know, and it should appeal to impatient people
like yourself.
Exactly.
So look, I know how much you. I mean, you. What's that line where you don't mind the footlights, but you don't actually want to be the person in the middle of the stage. So I'm extremely grateful for you coming in to visit today and having the chat.
Pleasure, Peter.
It was, I've found out things I didn't know about that I'm glad I did. Uncle Rod, thank you very much for coming in and enjoy the rest of it.
Absolute pleasure.
Take care.
In the next episode, Peter Ricks speaks to the man known as the Song Doctor, record producer Charles Fisher. From Old 55 to Air Supply, Radio Birdman to Savage Garden, his life as a producer has been rich and diverse. That's next time on From the Inside. From the Inside with Peter Ricks. Listener.